Chapter 28, It's Greek to Me by Willie Snow Etheridge. 28, Bombed Budapest. The Commission's next move was to Geneva to write the report on their findings. They chose Geneva because it was in a neutral country and they would be free from the pressures and demonstrations that had dogged them in Greece, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia. My mode of transportation to Geneva was by car, no Jeep this time. W.H. Lawrence, known to all his friends as Bill, and one of the New York Times' few roving reporters, invited Norbert and me to drive with him in a new red, low-slung Pontiac, which he had just brought over from the United States. He would have been happy to take the roommate, too, but of course the roommate insisted he had no time to motor. He must fly as fast as the wings of the airplane could take him. Incidentally, the air mode of travel was popular with practically everyone except me. When the plane flew, delegates of countries who had no planes assigned to them, newspapermen, photographers, and members of the secretariat frequently thumb rides on it. For a day or two before each scheduled flight, the telephone in the roommates in my room was busy with requests for rides. Early the day before the plane was to take off from Belgrade for Geneva, the phone rang, and I, who acted constantly as the roommate secretary without pay, answered it and heard a nice male voice saying, "This is Lieutenant Hancock." "Lieutenant Hancock? Lieutenant Hancock?" Stars, the name sounded very familiar, but still I could not place it. Where had I heard it before? "Oh, how are you, Lieutenant Hancock?" I answered with warmth, although my mind was cold. He was fine, and how was I? I was fine, too. And who had he been doing, and what had he had been doing with himself? Window shopping, sightseeing, taking pictures. And what had I been doing with myself? Finally, he asked, "Do you know what time Mr. Etheridge's plane is to take off for Geneva?" "The exact hour hasn't been set yet," I answered. "The plane has to wait for the United States members who went on that little investigation trip to Skopje. But why? Do you want to catch a ride on it?" "No, thank you. I'm the pilot." The plane was to make an overnight stop in Rome, but we, who were going by car, were to stop in Budapest, Vienna, Salzburg, Berchtesgaden, and Bern. I was so pleased at the prospect I could scarcely stand it. "Aren't you excited?" I asked Norbert. Smiling tolerantly at what he considers my over-exuberance, he answered, "Yes, in a restrained way." Bill Lawrence is an exceedingly successful newspaper man in his early 30s. He roams rather freely about the world, writing those stories that interest him, and trust, with interest, the management of the New York Times and its thousands of readers. His headquarters were, and perhaps still are, at Bucharest, and his beat was Yugoslavia, Bulgaria, Romania. But for weeks he has been covering the commission. He is short and stocky, with a fleshy face and small bright blue eyes. Usually he is gay and full of teasing and laughter, but, like most of the newspaper men I've known, extremely temperamental. He can get out of sorts when he is tired faster than the roommate. Between him and Norbert, I had my ears pinned back constantly. I could have stayed home and had better treatment. The first thing after we started off, Bill asked, "Have you got your door locked so you won't fall out?" "Don't tell me you'd care," said I. "No, but we'd lose time stopping to pick you up." As I didn't have it locked then, nor at any other time, he inquired, he fell into remarking, "I was even able to reach my 9-year-old son to do that, to teach my 9-year-old son to do that after a few hours." At last he quit asking me. He simply said in a weary tone to Norbert, "My friend, you'd better take over the job, too. It's really too much of a strain for her." The morning we left Belgrade was sunny and warm, and all along the good highway, peasants were out in the fields, plowing the black land, spreading manure upon it, sowing seed. Yugoslavia has amazingly fertile farmland, at least amazing to me. I had heard so much about Mihailovic's and Tito's bands fighting in the mountains during the war that I had thought there were mountains everywhere to hide behind. And, of course, there are many mountains to the south and west, but that day, driving north and slightly west, we never saw a mountain, not even a hill. For mile after mile, the land lay smooth as a dance floor with mammoth parquetry of young grain and plowed earth. It reminded me of that lovely section of Ohio that one drives through after leaving Cincinnati on the way to New York. Except here there were no advertising signs, no fences, no neglected spots. And such horses. As a Kentuckian, I was astounded that another land could have so many beautifully built, sleek horses. They looked as if they should be racing at Churchill Downs, for they were not stocky but slender, and their coats shone like unpowdered noses. There were many hogs and cows, too, and of course sheep. Around noon, we approached the Yugoslavian-Hungarian border. We were nervous about our chances of getting into Hungary. It, like Bulgaria, was under the Allied Control Commission, Soviet High Command, and as we three well knew, Russia doesn't care for people wandering around her domains. We had our passports and visas and Allied force permits in order, but we did not have a Russian road pass. And that, we had been told, was very necessary. It had been issued in Budapest, Bill understood, and we had waited over a day for it in Belgrade, but it had never come. Now, of course, we might be turned back at the border. It was not a happy prospect. Of all countries, we felt we must see Hungary. Not only was Budapest a city we longed to visit, but we'd like to take our hats off to a country which was still holding out against the communists. Even occupied by Russian troops, estimated at around 100,000, the Smallholders' Party in the last elections had received 59% of the votes against the communists, 17%. How long this state of affairs could continue seemed very doubtful to my companions and me, for we had seen the communists take over governments with smaller minorities than that. What we considered particularly sinister that April day was the fact that the communists held both the Ministry of Interior, which embraces all the police and powerful political section, and the Ministry of Education. As we knew from reading the papers, the Minister of the Interior was as busy as he could be arresting members of the majority and trying them for treason. And even I, who am a novice at politics, could see that if the minority continued to arrest the majority, why, shortly the minority would be the majority. In February, the communists, following their tried and true pattern, unearthed a dangerous plot, quote-unquote, involving, of course, quote-unquote, highly placed persons. Among them was Bella Kovacs, Secretary General of the Smallholders' Party, and 20 other members of the government. They had been in jail ever since and undergoing, we felt sure, the most ghastly torture. Peter Gabor, Hungary's chief of police, who for many years was a member of the Soviet secret police in Moscow, was in charge of the torture, and he, in time, would no doubt announce that he had, quote-unquote, obtained a confession that, quote-unquote, involved other highly placed persons. Now, these next paragraphs are in parentheses. Less than 2 months after we approached Hungary with this mixture of pride and foreboding, and only a few weeks after I wrote about it, the Hungarian premier, Ferenc Nagy, was involved by Kovacs' confession and ordered by Matyas Rákosi, Hungary's communist boss, to return immediately to Budapest from Switzerland, where he was vacationing. Knowing he would be shot if he returned, he took a plane for the United States, where he and his family, I suppose, will spend the rest of their lives in exile. Foreseeing this turn of events was not clever on our parts. 2 or 3 years ago, Arthur Kessler described the Russians' persecution tactics for obtaining confessions with painful accuracy in the powerful novel Darkness and Noon. And since then, we had read of many examples from real life. To mention only one, a man arrested and imprisoned with Kovacs smuggled a note out of his prison cell saying, "The interrogation was a nightmare. I was allowed to lie down only 6 hours in 2 weeks. I stood for 24 hours continuously." Then, having done away with the leaders of the smallholders' party, the communists arranged for a new election on August 31st. Violence and fraud were open and blatant, according to our own government observers. The Russians were taking no more chances. The last figures I saw gave the communists 248,060 votes. The Social Democrats, who work hand in hand with the communists, 191,800, and the smallholders, 183,223. End of parentheses. At the border that April day, before these final Russian moves to take over Hungary, both Bill and Norbert went into the official's office to flourish our passports and Allied force permits. Happily and surprisingly, there were no Russians around, only Hungarians, and they did not ask for the road pass. Pleased, we sailed on toward Budapest until a blowout stopped us. While Bill and Norbert struggled to change the tire, I sat in the car and listened there in the middle of Hungary at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon to the album of familiar music and suffered a faint touch of homesickness. Evelyn MacGregor, whom the roommate enjoys so, sang, "When you are away, dear, how lonesome are the hours," or words to that effect, and, "Oh, how I miss you, dear old pal of mine." It was too much. I turned off the radio and gave my attention to the changing of the tire. Already, 8 other people were giving their attention, too. Evidently, in that section of Hungary, the changing of a tire is extremely rare. Something like glimpsing the Borealis in Kentucky. One dark-eyed little boy who was watching eased up to me and asked, "Amerikansky?" "Yes," I answered, nodding my head, "Amerikansky." "You speak English?" he asked in English. I smiled, "Certainly." "In America you speak English?" "Naturally." He looked dumbfounded. Evidently he thought we of the United States spoke Indian, or perhaps only grunted. Coming into Budapest on the flat Pest side, we saw immediately smashed walls, fallen roofs, twisted steel. I was shocked. I had seen some destruction in Sofia and Belgrade, but nothing to approach this. Here, all around me were pieces of wall standing like old gravestones, mounds of powdered mortar and shattered brick. "It is awful," I mourned. "Perfectly awful." "This is nothing," said Norbert. "Wait till you see Buddha." But before we saw Buddha, we drove into the heart of Pest, looking for the American legation. Across the broken streets, innumerable flags of Hungary and Russia were flying side by side. "It must be a holiday," we kept saying, but we could find no one to tell us what holiday. The few people who spoke English shrugged their shoulders and said it was nothing. The Hungarians are always having holidays. But finally we found a man who knew. The next day, the Russians were to unveil a great monument on the highest point in Buda to celebrate Hungary's liberation from the Germans by their Russian saviors. There would be parades, bands, speeches, flags, wreaths. Why, the Social Democrats alone were going to lay 92 wreaths. I was excited at the prospect and wanted to stay over another day to see it. I kept arguing I had never seen a wreath laid, but my companions refused to be interested. "Of course, now, if you want to stay, you're welcome," Bill said pleasantly every time I began to argue. "I understand you can catch a very good plane from here. Or, if there's no plane, I'm sure there must be a train. Please don't let us stop you." But I did see this statue. There's no way to avoid seeing it. It stands on the highest point of the highest spot in Buda, like the figurehead on the prow of a ship. It is a giant bronze figure of a woman leaning into the wind, holding a sheath of some sort. I trust olive leaves above her head. Her full skirts flare out behind her. The monument to Russia is practically the only thing standing on those heights of Buda. Everything else was razed during those two fearful months that the Russian artillery bombarded Budapest, day and night, to rout the Germans. The once magnificent palace is now only mounds of brick and mortar, spilling into the street, twisted, rusted steel tangling around concrete blocks, broken marble statues tumbling down long flights of smashed stairs, and roofless walls limping a little way toward the light. For an hour, perhaps, in the late afternoon, we wandered miserably among the ruins. A lone chandelier hung tipsily from a gaping ceiling in what I took to be the former ballroom of the... And at one entrance, the head of a huge marble lion rolled in the dust. Shivering with depression and cold, we wound our way down that steep hill to the bank of the Danube and rode slowly along it. Only one bridge crossed the river from Buda to Pest that afternoon, but a pontoon bridge was under construction and would be complete by the next day for the unveiling ceremonies. All the lovely old suspension bridges that in former years had swung like deep necklaces from shore to shore now lay broken and rusted below the surface of the water. That evening we joined Donald Bigelow, a member of the American legation, and Mrs. Bigelow to talk politics and to sample the Hungarian drink, Barax. It is distilled from peaches, and as I sipped a small glass to keep from hurting my host's feelings, of course, I kept thinking that if Georgia, with all her peaches, ever learned how to make it, everybody would be governor. There wouldn't be just three. The next morning, we ate the best breakfast we had had in the Balkans, which once again highlighted the incongruity of life in that part of the world. There we were, sitting at a table covered with shining white linen, eating oranges, fresh crusty rolls, ham and eggs, coffee with pitchers of whipped cream, while all around us lay broken mortar and pulverized bricks. The Hotel Bristol, where we were staying, was the only whole building in its block. And that, too, we heard, had been hit, but not too badly to be repaired. Yet we had every comfort. But not only our breakfast was incongruous, the windows of the still-standing stores were just as unbelievable. While Bill maneuvered for gas and collected the patched-up tire, Norbert and I wandered about the streets, peering in the windows. Next to a lot, in which only one jagged piece of wall remained, there would be a window filled with exquisite china, service plates, platters, cups and saucers, lamps. In another, a breath-catching purple hat with pink roses. In another, exquisitely tooled leather bags, belts, gloves. But the display most astounding to me in those streets of shattered walls and caved-in roofs was a florist window. It was the Saturday before Easter, and the window was heavenly with Easter arrangements, starring all my favorite flowers. There were mostly tiny baskets, tucked with pansies and hyacinths and violets and forget-me-nots. But there was one huge Easter egg made entirely of the soft gray buds of the pussy willow, and from its sides dropped a dozen bright red carnations. These luxury goods were for the new godless communist aristocracy in Budapest. There was a goodly number of them, we understood, living in the best houses that were left intact and riding in fine automobiles. No doubt they enjoy baskets of red carnations and people purple hats on Easter morning as keenly as Christians. End of chapter 28.